David's Law: How the Amos Attack Will Be Used to Control the Internet, by Kit Knightley. On October 15th, Sir David Amos MP was attending a constituency surgery at Belfair's Church in Leon C. During the meeting, a young man emerged from the crowd and stabbed the MP several times. Ambulances and police were called. They attempted to revive him at the scene, but he was declared dead. The suspect, meanwhile, made no attempt to flee. It has since been reported he is the son of a Somali politician, was known to the UK's Prevent Counter-Terrorism Programme, and was reportedly radicalised online. The killing is being treated as a terrorist incident. These are the alleged facts in the case, as they have been released to the public. Are they true? Maybe, maybe not. It's too early to say, and we'll likely never know for sure. The truth is, for everyone outside the Amos family and friends, it really isn't the most pressing issue. Whatever the reality of the attack, what we, the 99%, need to be most concerned about is the agenda coming in its wake. Real attack or not, false flag or not, the fallout is the same. Censorship, state control, and David's Law. The Online Harms Bill. The first reaction to the Amos attack has been renewed coverage of and loud calls for the Online Harms Bill to be put to a vote. All this despite there being no publicly released evidence linking the Amos attack to any online harms at all. The Online Harms Prevention Bill is not in any way a response to Amos's death and has actually been in development for a while. A white paper reporting the need for the bill was first published in April 2019. Then updated in December 2020. This was followed by a draft bill in May 2021 and then a report on regulating online harms, published in August. The bill has existed for over 18 months, and any attempts to link it to David Amos are purely manipulative tactics designed to force it through Parliament on a wave of emotion. It might be dismissed by some as callous to talk about the alleged murder of a seemingly innocent person in terms of cynical agenda. But it's the very opposite. It's an expression of concern and social responsibility. The establishment uses these events as gambits, so we have to get used to reading them as such if we want to protect the rights and freedoms that will be freshly attacked. We're already seeing a deluge of coverage in the press, talking up the dangers of our toxic political discourse and the threat that divisive polarized speech poses because it can radicalize people and create the climate where violence becomes inevitable. The Mirror warns of an increase in bedroom radicals thanks to lockdowns. The Guardian echoes this, claiming online hate is nastier than ever and action is required. The Telegraph headlines: Social media companies must do more to protect MPs from online hate. Politicians are likewise prepping the ground for the bill to pass. Deputy Prime Minister and Justice Secretary Dominic Raab went on Sky News to talk about online hate being out of control. Sir Keir Starmer, leader of the supposed opposition, used the first PMQ since the attack to rail against the lack of regulation of the internet and call for something to be done. Boris has already committed to bringing the online harms vote forward before Christmas, when it was previously expected to wait until at least spring of 2022. So what's in this bill? Nothing much that hasn't been said before. The white paper and report proselytize about the need to protect children, women, ethnic minorities, and the vulnerable from hate. The bill itself suggests a new statutory duty of care for the internet and a new regulatory body with a suite of powers to ensure companies fulfill this duty of care. There are chapters dedicated to actual crimes, such as child pornography and threats of violence, but also much murkier harms described as legal but harmful. These include, but are not limited to, disinformation and bullying. As always, the language of legislature is deliberately obscure, shrouded in the muddied meaning of bureaucratic double talk. One concrete and concerning clause would grant Ofcom the power to demand private user information from internet powers and social media companies, although we do know they do this already. but the most dangerous part of the bill may not even be written yet. David's Law. Within days of the news breaking, Tory MPs were calling on Boris Johnson to enact David's Law. David's Law would be either new legislation or a strengthening of the current proposed legislation to totally remove online anonymity. Tory MP Mark Francois said in a speech to the Commons, quote, "So let's put, if I may be so presumptuous, David's Law onto the statute book, the essence of which would be that while people in public life must remain open to legitimate criticism, they can no longer be vilified or their families subject to the most horrendous abuse, especially from people who hide behind a cloak of anonymity with the connivance of the social media companies for profit." End quote. Priti Patel is already considering taking away the right to anonymity online. Other politicians, including Dominic Raab and Lindsay Hoyle, the Speaker of the House, have expressed total agreement. Politico headlines the UK is wrestling with anonymity. But what exactly would ending anonymity entail? That's not clear. The white paper discusses how anonymous accounts can be used to hide illegal activity and that companies should do more to prevent this, but there is nothing in there about outright banning them. Any such formal ban would involve amending the bill or writing a new one. Hence we have talk in Parliament of strengthening the proposed legislation. But does that mean a ban? Perhaps. Perhaps not. A more likely and more British approach, as we are already seeing with vaccine passports, would be to make it an informal ban by pressuring the companies themselves to act outside of legislative compulsion. Parliament will author new guidance or recommendations on the opening of social media accounts without ever enforcing them as law. But partner this with steep fines for illegal activity, hate speech or misinformation, along with the proposal to make platforms criminally liable for harmful content, and companies become their own strict censors in the name of protecting their profit margin. This is not a fringe theory at all. MP David Davis, of all people, described exactly this process in warning that the Online Harms Bill could become a censor's charter. It's not hard to see how that system could be used to totally remove the idea of online anonymity without ever making it actually illegal, but rather making it too financially risky, thus skirting any accusations of state censorship or authoritarianism. We already know major internet players work hand in glove with governments all around the world, so they can be relied upon to enforce any new duty of care regulations. But the smaller competitors, who use privacy as a major selling point, can expect to be put in the media crosshairs. Enter Telegram. The war on Telegram. Telegram, for those who aren't familiar, is an encrypted private messaging service created by Russian Pavel Durov. It became the go-to encrypted service after Facebook bought WhatsApp, and its channel feature is a very useful way to communicate with thousands upon thousands of people at once. During the pandemic, it has become a hub for those organizing protests and broadcasting information banned from mainstream platforms. All of that has clearly put it on the state's hit list, because somehow, in all the outpouring of emotion following Amos's stabbing, it is Telegram that comes in for specific criticism. To be clear, Telegram is not yet known to have played any part whatsoever in the attack on David Amos. None. It's not even known whether or not the alleged killer had a Telegram account. Despite this, yesterday in Parliament, Sir Keir Starmer attacked Telegram as the app of choice for extremists. Interestingly, he was citing a report from the NGO Hope Not Hate, which was released on October the 13th, just 2 days before Amos was stabbed. In fact, Telegram has been the subject of ongoing media smears for years, and these have only intensified in the last few days. Back in 2016, Gizmodo was telling people they should delete Telegram right now, ironically, because it wasn't really encrypted enough. This story was repeated by Vice in November 2020 and then Wired in January of this year. Also in January, following the riot on Capitol Hill, Telegram was accused of being a safe haven for the far right. Headline from Vox: Why right-wing extremists' favorite new platform is so dangerous. Headline from Washington Post: Far-right groups move online conversations from social media to chat apps and out of view of law enforcement. In April, Forbes reported that Telegram was dangerous. In May, it was a platform where cyber criminals share stolen data. And then in June, the New York Times called it a misinformation hotspot. A September article in Politico accuses Telegram of allowing misinformation intended to influence the recent German election. Also in September, the Financial Times called Telegram a new dark web for cybercriminals. And an October article in Wired accuses the platform of being a cesspool of anti-Semitic content. It goes on and on and on. Most tellingly, Telegram is regularly blamed for COVID-related misinformation, along with selling fake vaccine passes and allowing threats to NHS workers. Are you seeing the pattern? Well, are you? Although all of this is framed as a response to the death of David Amos, none of it has yet been shown to have any relevance to the Amos case at all, and all of it predates the murder happening. The Online Harms Bill is almost 3 years old. The attacks on Telegram have been going on for over a year, and you can find a steady stream of media attacks on online anonymity going back over a decade. As so often, the reaction to this problem is selling us a solution they've had planned for years. Since at least 2016, MPs have been talking about reclaiming the net, while outlets like The Guardian have been talking about creating the web we want and producing tortured statistical reports to paint the web as a dangerous place. Interesting note, those butchered statistics are referenced in the Online Harms White Paper, a little insight into the self-sustaining nature of propaganda. The lesson we should all learn: policy is never a response. Policy is an aim, a predetermined conclusion. It is decided and written, and then the reality that justifies that policy is constructed, either through opportunistic use of real tragedies, cultivated public opinion, false flag attacks, or pure invention. There's a link to follow Off Guardian's Telegram channel at the bottom of the article. For now. Unlike The Guardian, Off Guardian are not funded by Bill and Melinda Gates or any other NGO or government, so a few coins in our jar to keep us going are always appreciated. Thank you.